Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. Today's episode features actress, writer, and director Wendy McComb and Winnipeg punk band Screaming at Traffic. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Indecision keeps me up. My first guest is an actress, writer, and director who has appeared on such TV shows as How I Met Your Mother, Community, The Office, The Intern, Comedy Bang Bang, as well as several shorts for College Humor. She has written and directed several short films and has just released her debut feature, Birds Without Feathers, in which she also stars as the lead character. This is my conversation with Wendy McComb. Wendy McComb, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
So you have a film out, Birds Without Feathers. I got a chance to see it. I love all of it. And I know you sort of developed it with one of your co-stars, but where did this initial idea come from for you?
The movie originated with me, and then I kind of credit all my co-stars and everybody in the film to creating it. I think creating a movie is a group effort. It's a dark comedy, a feature film, and it Birds Without Feathers originated basically because I went through a trauma in my life that caused me to wake up. And I don't know if you've been through this spiritual awakening, but it's utter hell to go through it. It's just a bunch of trying really, really hard, thinking you know the answer, and then being like, damn it, I'm back to square one again. So that's where I pulled the dark comedy from, and that's why I decided to make it a dark comedy, because it's pretty representative of life, I think.
The dialogue struck me as very naturalistic, and I'm curious how much of that dialogue was improvised or created throughout the process, and how much of that was written.
It's a wild process we did. During the film, right before it, I took a class called Meisner. It's an acting technique, and in it you repeat a lot. And I just thought that was a perfect technique to bring into the film, because such is this process of trying to figure out how to be the person you always wanted to be. There's a lot of repeating until you understand how to go the path you want. So there's lots of elements of repetition in the film, and that might be what you notice about how naturalistic it is. Every actor, except for one of them, was a Meisner actor. And they're able to basically act off each other really well in the scene. And actually, it's 90% scripted, the film. And it's surprising, but, you know, they train you to just be so natural with each other and react to each other. And that's why I just love these performances. I wrote each part for each person specifically. So they are just kind of being themselves, or at least how I saw them. And I feel like that's why it's so naturalistic, and it's surprising that it's 90% written. But I met with each actor beforehand, before each day to shoot, to make sure the words that they're saying felt true to them. So I like to work with the actors a lot.
And was it always going to be a foregone conclusion that you were going to be in the movie as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've made over 50 short films. They're all online, and I've acted in, I think, 80% of them. And that was my primary occupation before becoming a director, which over the last 5 years has just become like something super lucrative and like important to me. I love expressing feeling through film, and then also being like, the characters I usually play, I'm finding out are like the spectator or like the camera itself, which I often feel like that in real life. So it's kind of a nice character to throw in there.
You mentioned that you wrote the film specifically for each actor. As a writer, director, as a collaborator, what's it like working on that process with friends and people that you already know?
I mean, I love it. I mean, I know these people are committed. I know who they, I feel like I know who they are. And that's in the best sense. I mean, I believe in seeing people's dark and light, and really emphasizing the dark, I guess. But nothing really is dark. It's like some of these people saw the film later and they were like, what? They were like, some of the actors flipped out at the premiere at the festivals because they were shocked how vulnerable it was. I think when you're in it, you think you're playing a character. But in the end, it's almost like you get duped, like, whoa, how did Wendy know me so well? Or how did she capture that part of me through the mirror? You know, how did she capture that? And I think some people were a bit shocked and almost embarrassed, because we don't like to show our dark parts. You know, we don't show all of me. You won't love all of me. You know, show just the good side. And it's like, no, all of it is good. And especially in Birds Without Feathers, I mean, you see how much vulnerability can bring togetherness and bring people to feel not so alone in life, because we're actually showing all of ourselves.
You know, I think as an audience member and as a storyteller, we do find ourselves attracted to the dark side, or the more mysterious side of humanity. What is the appeal for you as a filmmaker and as a storyteller?
Well, it's just honesty. I feel like we are conditioned as humans to not be honest, and therefore a lack of connection is perfect, and we're full of shame. We're having moments of sadness or moments of worry or strife, and we have to say we're fine. And I don't know who decided to make that a reality for us, but it's truly not the way. And I think that's why, when you're saying we're so drawn to that, it even lights up it in me to realize, like, yeah, we're all missing that. We're all missing that vulnerability or the opportunity to speak and be heard.
How difficult is it to portray that vulnerability on the screen? Because I think in society they do teach us to have almost a fear of being vulnerable.
Yeah, which sucks, and it's just sad. I think for me it's easy, because I feel like I have felt like a bird without feathers my entire life, because I am so vulnerable. And during this process of waking up, you realize, like, oh wait, like, no, I'm just a human. That was fun. But I think Meisner, the class, really woke that up for, it really shook up the actors for me. Like, they were already, you know, bendable by that time I got to them, by that time I had watched them in classes, because Meisner only encourages truth and vulnerability. And if you're not vulnerable in class, if you're not truthful, I mean, there's no script for 10 months when you're in that class. Most people leave after 2 weeks because they're like, uh-oh, this is what acting is? We have to be honest? I don't even know myself. You know, it's just like a boot camp until you progress to the scripted stuff. So for me in this film, it was truly easy. One, because I think that's what I fancy in life. I fancy vulnerability. And two, because I chose actors or other humans, other birds that were more than willing to shed their mask for the camera and and it's truly a gift.
Your character in the film, Janet, or Neil, is an aspiring sort of social media influencer personality type person. What do you think that means in this day and age to be an influencer?
Well, it's to be loved. It's to make money, and it's to not be present, I think. But, you know, we all want to make money. We all want a distraction from our wounds. That's a deeper thing. I mean, power to the people for making money. No knocking on that. I really have no judgment. But if we want to get dark comedy with it, it really is a distraction from self for at least most people. I can't speak to everyone.
Speaking of self, I found the character of Daniel almost ironic and a bit meta, because he's a self-help, aspiring self-help person who doesn't know how to help himself. And that's a huge industry. Do you see a lot of ironies in that type of lifestyle?
Well, of course. I mean, that's why I made a dark comedy. I mean, life is so funny. I've had friends that just go into, like, learn how to be a psychologist, you know, and it's like, or I've had a roommate once who was studying to be a love coach. And I just remember she had no life experience, and I just thought that was so funny. I mean, I have no judgment, but I just think it's like, us humans, we're all really just trying to figure it out, and it's like, I love seeing life on the more humorous side, because it's kind of like I said, shining a light on just how ridiculous we really are on the inside, and you know, holding ourselves to high standards and all trying to be loved and all trying to be liked when we aren't even looking at ourselves, our true selves, not even showing our true selves. So I think it's funny.
I gotta ask about the continued references to Jeff Goldblum. What was it about Jeff Goldblum that you sort of wanted to make this joke about in the film?
Well, it's just as simple as me talking to the actors, and I said to Alex Safko, who plays the Russian cowboy, I said, is there anybody you'd want to be in love with? And he said, Jeff Goldblum. And so I just, like, wrote his storyline to this Jeff Goldblum thing. So it's just kind of like I let the actors influence me, but also it helps me give them a script that will let them have the best performance possible.
You obviously wrote the script, but how much of this story was there, and how much did this story change throughout the creative collaboration?
Well, I think, like, for the creative collaboration, I mean, this movie was made with barely any pre-production, and it was kind of just, like, I wrote 10 pages a day. Sometimes I would get a whole week to write it before we would shoot, and then I'd get to meet with actors. We would never shoot without a shooting script, but most of it was made just by myself, and most of it stayed the way it was. The only differences were when we were on set, sometimes things would change due to, like, low budget, or like how I met with Alex and was like, who do you want the person to be? But the storyline was always there, and none of this storyline is real. I would say it's heavily influenced by moments in my life and moments in my trauma. I'd say the manipulation was all real. I can't say who it was in my life, but it wasn't a person named Joe. But we've all met someone named Joe, like somebody who, you know, wants to manipulate you or take advantage of your kindness or steal your identity, which she does in the film. We've all met those people. So it's like, a lot of it isn't influenced by my real life. The comedian is a real character, but he had a different occupation in real life. So I just place people like the comedian, for example, into similar situations I saw that person in real life with a comedic and also changed his occupation. So if that makes sense. And then the Janet character, I will say a lot of those things very close to my real life happened to me. I'm being very vulnerable in the film. I mean, at the time I was a shell of a human being just trying to make my way out. So a lot of that, like the relationship stuff, is very real. But again, all the situations they're in are just magnified to the extreme. Like they are so surreal, in my opinion, but yet grounded, like you're saying. And it's a pretty fun mix.
And is that where you get the title from? Because when I think of it, it sort of brings to mind almost an emotional nakedness and vulnerability. Is that?
Yeah.
Did the title come fairly early on for you?
Yeah, it was the first thing I thought of. I honestly had one really awful title before it, but then within 10 minutes I changed it. I was just like, working title, The Clouds Are White. And I was like, definitely not that. Birds Without Feathers. Okay, that'll be the working title. We'll think about it later. Like, I'm very much like a movement type creator. I don't like to dwell on things. I try to trust my subconscious, because in the end, like, literally editing the film, I really realized, like, all my choices. You just trust yourself heavily that your subconscious is speaking to you while you're directing, your instincts. And then in the editing room, for example, you realize, like, oh, that's sad. That's why that scene happened. Or, yes, that's why I named it Birds Without Feathers. It is a vulnerable piece, and I think life is vulnerable, especially if you feel like you're a bird without feathers. Technically, a bird without feathers is left to die, and they don't get a family. They don't have anywhere they belong. That's the technical thing for a bird without feathers. And then the metaphorical sense is, do you not have feathers, or have you had them your whole life, and you're choosing to look into the false mirrors around you? And that's up to the audience to decide, I think, after they see this film.
The characters in the film are all looking for love in various ways. Do you think they, by the end of the film, they achieve what they set out to do?
I think so, but I think that's up to the viewer. I mean, like, we choose our own truths, you know? And that's whatever it means to you. And your truth is your truth.
And do you think for a lot of them, though, and maybe you have feelings about this as the creator, that maybe it's more about loving oneself than another person?
Is that what you took from it?
Yeah, I think so. I think especially for the character of Janet, that there's an aspect of self-love and self-expectance, I think, before anything else.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that each character, you can decide for yourself, like, what it means to you. And usually, people, when they gravitate to a character, it speaks to their story. And that's what I love about the film, is that everyone will have a different take on each character, if they liked them or hated them, or if they can relate to them. And I just love that so much.
And you got to shoot, I know you actually shot on location in Vegas. What was that experience like, actually being able to go down there and shoot?
It was wild. I mean, like, I have the most amazing crew. I mean, my cinematographer is Nate Cornett. I mean, I've worked with him for 5 years. And I think we were into, like, 20 days of shooting at the time, and I was definitely having tunnel vision. Like, I was like, we have to go there for this shot. And in my head, I'm thinking there's, like, a lot more to shoot there, because we're, like, on a high. We just shot, like, in the desert, you know, with Joe at her ranch. And we're like, let's go. We have to go to Vegas. We're going to make this a double stop because it's only an hour away. And everyone's like, great. I got everybody hotels. And then we get this, like, majorly amazing shot, plus one more inside the casino shot. hotel rooms, it's like 3 a.m., and then I'm just kind of, like, looking in the mirror, like, wait, is that all we're here for? Like, I was shocked. I was like, oh, my God. And then, so what was it like? It was thrilling. It was amazing. And then, literally, we all just had diner food the next morning, and we're like, okay, good job, guys. See you back in L.A.
We talked about that. What would you say, do you have a favorite memory or moment from shooting that stands out to you?
Oh, man. I mean, that's one of the favorite ones. And it was a while ago now, so I'm, like, trying to think. I mean, there was a lot of moments. There's, like, one moment where I asked the Russian cowboy character played by Alex Sasko to... I asked him to do nudity for the sex scene he's in, and he would not do it. It was really funny. And then on top of it, there's a deleted scene where he's masturbating alone and fast. And after that scene was filmed, it's not in the film. After that scene was filmed, he came up to me and he goes, Wendy, I just want to be the hero, please. I just want to be the hero. And I just thought that was so sad and funny at the same time. So that didn't make this cut, but I kind of do think he ended up being a bit of a hero in the end. So I think that's a pretty good story.
Well, the film is Bird Without Feathers, and it opens August 14th, if I'm correct.
Yeah, August 14th, Tribeca, in New York City. At the Roxy Cinema, and then we go to LA and Toronto, and pre-sales for the film should be up soon, and please share a trailer, share a poster, anything that is shared helps movies like this get made, and I promise you, it's a pretty wild film and worth seeing.
Birds of the Feathers, Wendy McComb, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you so much. With you.
All right. Cheers.
Okay, bye.
That was Wendy McComb. Her film Birds Without Feathers is in theaters now. Here's a song by Screaming at Traffic from their album I Don't Like Sports. This is their single, Broken Teeth.
Spinning, are we having fun?
Screaming at Traffic is a punk rock band from Winnipeg, Manitoba, made up of Jacques Richer, Duncan Murta, Paul Coleman, and Stefan St-Gaudard. Their no-frills emo punk riffing add to the group's frenzied live performance and raw yet melodic songwriting. After forming in May of 2017, Screaming at Traffic premiered their debut EP, SAT, via Idiotech.com, a Polish-based webzine. In July, the album became available on Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. The song Monstrosity, off the group's debut, was featured in a Spotify playlist curated by the Montreal-based website Punk Normal Activity. It also began charting on Earshot in October, reaching number 2 in Edmonton and ranked 9th on the National Loud Charts. Their debut full-length album, I Don't Like Sports, is out now. I spoke with Jacques and Paul last week.
I'm here with Jacques and Paul, Screaming at Traffic. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Excited to be here in Toronto. Excited to be chatting with you, Dan.
Yeah. You guys have your full length out. I Hate Sports.
I don't like sports.
I don't like sports.
Yeah, yeah. It's not as aggressive.
But yes. Yes.
Canadians are polite people, right?
Right, so, yeah. We don't hate anything. We just maybe dislike something. Is that a true statement for you guys? You don't like sports?
I actually don't think it really is. Like we watch a lot of hockey. You know, we're from Winnipeg, so you know, go Jets, go.
Yeah,
Blue Bombers.
I'm a Bombers fan. I like watching baseball too. I like sports.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't follow sports per se, but I don't mind like watching a hockey game and stuff like that. I do get pretty heated watching hockey. But that's kind of it for me. I'm not really into baseball, although we were on a baseball team this year. We had a slow pitch team back in Winnipeg called London Balling. And we just did a beer league, which is hilarious because we were on that team when we released I Don't Like Sports.
So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Well, like the other thing too is like a lot of our favorite bands, like for example, modern baseball or American football, right? They're all named after like sports and stuff. So we don't like sports.
It's really prominent in like emo and punk and stuff. Like the Isotopes have like their entire thing is they're like a baseball club band, and we just thought it was kind of like a funny tongue in cheek thing. Plus, it's one of the tracks we have is I Don't Like Sports. So, yeah.
Were you guys following Raptor Fever at all in Winnipeg?
I watched the final game. Yes. Congratulations, go Raptors. You guys did it.
I didn't watch the full last game. I think we had band practice.
Yeah, we practiced, and then we watched the back half of it.
Yeah. And I was, like, checking it on my phone and stuff. It was an exciting time. Like, I'm not a basketball fan at all, but I know, like, it's the first time that Raptors...
It's the first time, like, a championship has ever been north of the border.
Yeah.
In basketball.
In basketball, ever.
Well, I mean, there's only one Canadian team now, so...
Yeah, exactly.
There you go, right?
Yeah, it was kind of neat watching, like, the entire nation kind of, like, go behind them. And it was an interesting thing. Because, like, the same thing kind of happened on a smaller scale in Winnipeg when the Jets were in, like, the playoffs a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And, like, the entire city was, like, losing their minds.
I remember I actually made a phone call and dialed the wrong number. And it was just like, hey, I was like, is this so-and-so? They're like, nope, I must have the wrong number. He's like, you're right, go Jets, go. And it was like, go Jets, go. And that's just how the conversation ended, man. Like...
So it's crazy to see it like go from like that, like when we're talking about like the Jets in Winnipeg, to like the entire country going behind the Raptors when they're in the playoffs.
It happened. I mean, I wasn't in the city yet, but it happened a couple years ago when the Jays made the playoffs for the first time in 23 years. Yeah, like when the Jays made the playoffs in 2015, the same sort of thing. The country went berserk.
Yeah.
It was the first time that we had made the playoffs in 22 plus years.
We got a couple buddies who are really big Jays fans. Yeah. One actually that I can think of, Boone.
Yeah, Boone
a
is
a buddy of ours back in Winnipeg, is like really into the Jays.
So you are doing the cross country driving touring life. Driving from Winnipeg across the country, what's that experience like for you as a band?
It's kind of bizarre. I mean, like, because Winnipeg's like right outside of Winnipeg is like the dead center of Canada. And so we're like, it's weird because we got to do like a shot out east and then come back home for a couple days and then a shot out west. But it's kind of convenient at the same time.
Yeah, because
then you get like a break in the middle, like for a couple days. And
it's not like you're going from like Vancouver to Halifax or PEI and then coming back home, and you've got that whole major anticipation, right? Of like, God, I just kind of want to get home. Like, I'm excited for the show, but like, we've been on the road for 5 weeks, sort of thing. And this time for us, it's like, cool, we're going to do 2 weeks, take 3 days off, take 3 more weeks, come back home.
I mean, our van doesn't have air conditioning, which is unfortunate because we're touring in the summer, but I mean, what can you do?
But we've got space.
Yeah, we have a lot of space, which is nice. We finally bought a van, and we previously were like renting like Dodge Caravans, and I don't know how we did it. Like, now that we have like an actual touring vehicle,
like back seats at 90 degrees, right. You've got like stuff you're cramped in. We toured in a Kia Rondo once. That was nightmarish because we had one of the big seat folded down and half of your butt was on the folded down seat, and now we have this big old touring van, and we've got one guy in the first bench, another guy in the second bench, one guy driving, one guy up front, and we're all just laying down lounging. So air conditioning is missed, but it's still way better.
Yeah.
I remember reading this, being from the West, I read this old joke years ago about, because I'm from BC, and so it was, why is Winnipeg part of Western Canada? Do you guys feel that you're, do you feel like part of Western culture, or is Winnipeg its own thing?
I'd say Western culture.
Yeah, I'd say we take part of the West thing. I feel like there's a bit of a, at least in the musical community, there's a bit of like a tie-in for being like Western Canadian, right? Because like Ontario is Ontario, you got Toronto, which is like a hub.
Yeah.
And then Quebec has this like completely own thing going on, and like is also a huge hub, and like bands from Toronto or from Ontario can tour just Ontario and Quebec their entire like careers, really.
Yeah.
And like to get into the States and not ever really have to hit Western Canada.
Like we played with Pew 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 a little while ago, and it was their first time out west, and they've been a band for how long?
They just
never came out west because they didn't have to, right?
So I think Western bands kind of like at least have kind of an identity of being like, we're a little bit of the outsiders, but like we're still like serious about it, right? And we'll do the 24-hour drive to Toronto to play a show. And
actually, I'd like to kind of add on to something you just said, because like Jacques just said, we're a bit of the outsiders. And like, I kind of agreed with that until we actually started coming east. And I gotta say, the hospitality out in Ontario has been incredible. When we were coming out here, we all, you know, everybody has expectations. Everybody has this, like what you think it's gonna be.
Right.
And it hasn't been anything like it. And like, we never had any negative thoughts about Ontario or anything, but it was just like, okay, well, this is what we've heard from other touring bands that it's kind of like. And it's just been phenomenal. So like, I don't know if I feel like an outsider anymore, but like, it's good.
Yeah, it's definitely, I'd say, changed the view now that we are
doing
in the East. Well, east of Winnipeg, anyway. I know we've had a couple conversations with some like northern Ontario cities we played. We were like, yeah, we're on an eastern tour, and they're like, we're not east.
Like, it's like,
well,
yes, you're
east
are.
To us.
Yeah. But so we're north. It's like, no, I'm sorry, Winnipeg's north.
Well, I just live in, I feel like in Toronto there is definitely a big and close knit emo and punk scene.
Yeah.
Here, do you guys get that impression at all?
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, like, this is our first time playing Toronto, but like having played with a lot of bands from Toronto area, GTA, because we've played with the Penske File, Single Mothers, Pew 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 before, and they all seem to like really know each other and stuff, which is, it's cool. It seems really tight-knit, you know, and like I've had those bands introduce me to other bands in, you know, in the city, and like I've been checking out some more local like Toronto stuff, and yeah, it's great. It seems really tight-knit.
I read the description that says your band being emo punk exists somewhere between a constant state of sadness and anger.
Yeah.
to me, that state is disappointment. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate. I mean,
our parents would agree with that.
I mean, yeah, like a lot of our music is like, we're really like fast, happy music. But if you listen to the lyrical content, it's kind of like that. Like, it's angsty, right? It's like disappointment of like maybe how like life turned out, like all the things that like were like kind of were supposed to happen growing up, and we were told sure. were going to happen growing up. And I think that's kind of like everybody our age kind of has that like identity crisis where like, you know, it was like you're awesome, you're perfect at everything. Like your parents back in like the 90s, growing up in the 90s, like every kid was like a special, like one of a kind, you know, thing. And like growing up and like like
realizing what the world's actually like.
Yeah. And
not to put anything on the parents or be like I'm a millennial kind of attitude, but I think that there's a feeling like that, and I think it's accessible. And yeah, I think a lot of emo and punk, no matter what like decade you go into, has that kind of feel to it. Like Captain Jazz back in the like late 80s were, you know, still singing about the same kind of stuff we are. I think that's just like a...
like, God knows our parents probably went through the exact same thing, right? Yeah. Just maybe like a little bit different.
Yeah, like you can't tell me like Fugazi isn't like a super emotional, angsty band as well, right? So I think it's just I think it's just a thing that like everybody goes through, and that it really makes for like powerful music. And, you know, we take our like own unique, at least as a songwriter in the band, I take kind of a unique, like, my experiences and kind of make them accessible to other people through the music.
So how would you describe your writing process then as a band? Do you focus on the lyrics and everybody else contributes musically, or is it...
It's almost entirely collaborative.
Yeah, I'd say so. Me and Duncan are both singers and songwriters, so we'll come into the practice with, like, lyrics, kind of a loose chord structure, and we're like, this is kind of what we're doing, and then we all kind of get into it, and like Paul and Stefan add like some flourishes and do some producing on it, and like sometimes we'll change entire parts and be like, well, you know, a key change here would be cool, or what if we did something different here,
or we'll be jamming something even, and like all of a sudden like we'll jam, have another, and then like take a smoke break, have a beer, go do another jam, and all of a sudden we'll realize, wait a second, let's just put them together, right, and see how it goes. And sometimes like that's how we write. I wish Jacques Duncan and I have worked together for years and years and years, and then all of a sudden a couple years ago I met Stefan, and they had already been working with him in a different band. And so like if you think about it, the four of us have been kind of writing music for 4 or 5 years before the band even started.
Yeah
And like it just, yeah, we all just work together.
Yeah, and then yeah, everything in the band is we kind of like work together on, so and like we're all like best friends too. So I think it's a really like healthy band dynamic, and I think it works super well, you know.
And if there's one thing I could honestly say, it's like for any other band out there that might be listening to this, there's no bad ideas. Because we have that rule at band practice, like whether I'm coming in with the bass line, like everybody loves bass out of context, right? But like it doesn't matter. Like I come in, I'm like, guys, I wrote this bass line, I kind of like it. Can we fit it somewhere? No, we can't. Sorry. Or yeah, you know, maybe that'll work there. Like there's no wrong answers. Just play it and see if it works.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I was reading about you, and I know that your first EP, SAT, is it true that it got released through a Polish website or something?
It premiered on a Polish website, which is idiotech.com, which is kind of bizarre because we're a band from Winnipeg. But I mean, I just kind of like reached out and was like, you know, we hadn't played any shows yet really. Like it was like we had this thing recorded and we were like, what are we gonna do with it? And I was like, well, maybe we can get somebody to like premiere it. And so we had a website for Montreal Punk Normal Activity premiere our first single off the EP. And then this Polish webzine was like, yeah, absolutely. Just send me the link and I'll premiere it for you guys. So, yeah, we got some weird ties in Poland, I guess.
Fun fact, like, Jacques was like, yeah, we hadn't really played any shows. Our first show, we weren't even going to play. We were going to a house show and... the people that were running it were friends of ours, and they were like, holy god, the opening band got stopped at the border, and we got no one. And like the other band was running late into Winnipeg, and they needed somebody to fill time on this folk punk basement show. And Duncan, Jacques, and I were all at the show because we wanted to be there and see it. And we called Stefan, and he's like, and we're like, Stefan, you want to play? He's like, man, I'm already drinking with my buddy. And I was like, we're like, okay, sorry, man, we can't play. 3 minutes later, Stefan calls back. He's like, go get the gear, we're coming. And it's like, so like, that fun little anecdote, like,
yeah.
There, it seems like it's a very DIY ethic that suits you guys, right?
Yeah. We definitely started out very DIY. And even, like, to this day, like, you know, like, a lot of the posters and stuff we do is, like, I taught myself within the past 2 years that we've been a band on how to use, like, some pre-sourced, like, photo editing stuff just so we could do it ourselves. Our first EP was recorded in our living room and stuff like that. And we just, like, started out being like, let's just do this. Rather than wait around for somebody to, like, help us out. Like, let's just see what we can accomplish on our own and, like, go out. And, like, our first tour that we ever did was...
9 days or something like
that? Yeah, it was 9 days, like, 8 or 9 shows. And it was more shows on that tour than we had played up to that point. And we were just like, fuck it, let's just go for it.
But, you know, we came back home, and then the next show we played in Winnipeg, all of a sudden there were people at it, right?
Yeah, there was like 200 people at that show. And it was like, okay, well, I guess we're doing something right.
What does it mean to be punk, do you think?
I think it can mean anything you want it to mean. I don't think it has like necessarily like a specific definition. It's just kind of like doing what you want, but not being an asshole.
Yeah.
I think it's important to note, I don't think being punk means being an asshole.
I basically agree entirely with that. Just don't be a dick.
Do what you want without being a dick.
Right. The one thing about the punk community back home, at least, for sure, it is an inclusive place. Like, you want to go to a punk show, and you don't want to be in the mosh pit, no one's going to throw you in the mosh pit. If you jump in the mosh pit, cool. But, like, it's just anybody can come watch. We've played to people in their 60s. And everybody around them respects them, nobody bumps them, nobody does nothing, but, like, that's what being punk is really, too. It's just, like, don't be a dick, but include everybody as well.
Yeah.
What would you say your favorite song off I Don't Like Sports is? Do you have one?
Yeah, sure. Mine's the title track.
Yeah. I think mine, too, just... I Don't Like Sports, I wrote as like a very, like, it is a very personal song. It has kind of a flippant title, which doesn't necessarily speak to the content of it, but I think that song at least is the most meaningful to me personally. I don't know if I'd say it's my favorite, but just to kind of twist your question a little bit.
Yeah. It means the most. It's also one of the tunes that when we play live, we just end up always slamming out. So it's a ton of fun to play. There's key changes. There's difficult riffs. There's, like, heartfelt lyrics. It's got everything in it. So, like, most fun to play means the most. So I'm going to go with the title track on that.
I was sort of joking about being stuck in traffic earlier, but is screaming in traffic ever screamed at traffic?
All the time, yeah. Our drummer, Stefan, and Paul here are both pretty notorious for screaming at cars. especially on tour, when we're trying to navigate this massive one-ton van through fucking metropolitan Toronto traffic.
Oh, by the way, Stefan and Duncan did end up walking in on this interview behind us here.
Yes.
So, no, they might chirp in.
What has been the best touring memory you've had so far?
Oh, shit.
Pretty much. I don't know if I can even nail it down. Every tour we've been on, I've had a blast.
Because,
like, not only is it, like, we get to do what we want to do, I'm going basically on a road trip with, like, my 3 best friends, and we're playing music that we wrote, and, you know, I don't think there's one specific memory. We've made so many, like, good friends, and we've built, like, fan bases, especially in Western Canada, where we've actually toured a few times. And East, like, so far, has been amazing as well.
The hospitality out here has been incredible. Like, one of my favorite things about tour is lately we've been, like, playing, and then we'll be in the middle of one of our songs, and I'll look down, and there's maybe a couple people at the front, and they're screaming our lyrics right back at us. Like, but that's happened in a few cities, so I can't, like, pinpoint it. But, like, it's such a weird feeling being like coming up as from a Winnipeg punk band, and then all of a sudden we're in Calgary or we're in Sudbury. We're in Sudbury and people are asking us to go back on after all the sets are done, or we're in Calgary and people are screaming along to our lyrics. Like, the whole experience of tour is it's incredible.
Yeah, it's surreal. Yeah. I don't want to sound like I'm super cocky, but having people and like the music that you're playing and show genuine interest and coming up and chatting with us, and I think we've become friends with people, and every time we stop in a city, we're totally approachable. If you see us at a show,
please come say hi,
come have a beer, come out for a smoke with us, because we're we like to think we're pretty funny guys, at least at the very, very least.
We might bum a dart off you, but
that's fair. Yeah, you can easily do that in Vancouver, Victoria.
Yeah.
Well, the album is I Don't Like Sports. It's out now. You guys are here tonight at the Bovine Sex Club.
Yeah.
Well. Screaming at traffic. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dan.
That was my conversation with Jacques Richey and Paul Coleman of Screaming at Traffic. Their new album, I Don't Like Sports, is out now. And now, here is the title track off their album, I Don't Like Sports.
I'm
That was I Don't Like Sports by Screaming at Traffic off of their album of the same name. That does it for me today. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.